Listen up, Gallatin Valley and online listeners. You are hearing KGVM, Bozeman Community Radio, broadcasting at 95.9 FM and streaming at kgvm.org. The forecast looks like this will be a good time to hunker down next to a cozy fire to enjoy some stories that stir your imagination. And you are at the right place. This is Desert Oracle Radio Replay, and I'm your host, Roxana. We open today with the latest from Ken Lane's new series, and check out the title on this one. Released October 20th, 2025, here is The Eldritch Republic, Part 2, Thomas Jefferson's UFO.
D.O.R. From Desert Oracle Radio, this is The Eldritch Republic. Our new series that's all about America's strange history and uncanny folklore. I'm Ken Lane. Episode 2, Thomas Jefferson's UFO. Eldritch is a curious word, best known these days for describing a certain gloomy flavor of prose and poetry. The American Gothic writings of H.P. Lovecraft, Nathaniel Hawthorne, Washington Irving, and Edgar Allan Poe. You might call it the country's native tongue, the uncanny. The word eldritch goes back more than half a millennium, with the oldest known usage in a poem of 1508 by William Dunbar, master poet of Scotland. There was Pluto, the eldritch incubus, in cloak of green. William Dunbar was a macker, the Scottish term for poet, for bard. He was the macker in the court of the Stuart king, James IV. The king born at Stirling Castle in 1473 and battle slain on the 9th of September, 1513. We don't know how Dunbar died, or exactly when, but it was in relative poverty. The fate of many a poet, macker or not. Dunbar remains a national hero of Scotland, and you can see a fine statue of him at the Scottish National Portrait Gallery in Edinburgh, dressed in the Franciscan cowl and habit of his religious order. A descendant of this court poet, also named William Dunbar, but born in 1749, left his native Scotland for the New World at the age of 22. He had been quiet and bookish as a boy and had earned his master's degree at King's College in Aberdeen by 1767. With the few hundred pounds left to him when his father died, William Dunbar purchased some goods for export and landed at Philadelphia in 1771, working as a merchant. He prospered there and just 2 years later headed for the Mississippi, near the old French fort of Baton Rouge. Dunbar and another expatriate Scot, John Ross, established a plantation in what was then British West Florida. There he found tough, stubborn settlers who spoke an antiquated French. They were the Acadians, recently expelled from British Nova Scotia. The Cajuns. William Dunbar would live on the Mississippi for the rest of his days, though later moving upriver to found another plantation named The Forest and situated 9 miles south of Natchez. Like all such plantations, William Dunbar's farm made use of slave labor, as was the practice and custom of the French, Spanish, English, American, and Indian nations that held sway over the lower Mississippi River at the turn of the 18th century. One of many differences between past and present. William Dunbar raised a variety of crops, as well as a large family of his own. But his favorite work was always scientific in nature. Each crop was an experiment, carefully recorded, investigated for new uses. He created the square cotton bale to make transport easier, and he improved the cotton gin. He designed and manufactured a machine press for the extraction of cottonseed oil, an industry he pioneered. The unique weather and rhythms of river and bayou was of special fascination, and he kept detailed reports on hurricanes, establishing, for instance, the fact of the cyclone's eerily quiet eye. He discovered and extracted the fossilized bones of a mammoth, analyzed the chemical composition of the Arkansas hot springs, and officially defined the Spanish-American border as Surveyor General of what was called West Florida, a sparsely populated stretch of coastal lowlands, swamp, sand, river, and forest, along the Gulf Shore between the Big River and the Chattahoochee out of Georgia. The territory was rough and primitive, the conditions chaotic and often intolerable, as illustrated by the experience of one John Elliott, appointed British governor of West Florida in 1767, but unable to reach Pensacola for 2 years because of turmoil in the colony. It would prove to be his last political appointment. April 2, 1769. Governor Elliott arrived in Pensacola, assuming civilian governmental control. May 2, 1769. Governor Elliott committed suicide in his office. William Dunbar's experiences were often as harrowing, though he never gave up. In 1775, he lost many of his slaves to insurrection, common on the river in those days. In 1778, bandits raided his farm. A year later, in 1779, the Spanish, quote, plundered his plantation, burned his fences, and destroyed his crops. And in 1792, Dunbar moved 124 miles upriver and built his beloved plantation he named The Forest. At his new property, as before, native flora and fauna were cataloged, waterways and natural features surveyed and mapped, and the intertribal sign language of Mississippi River Indians collected and interpreted. Dunbar was the archetype of the field scientist, out in the world, ever alert to strange incidents requiring investigation and evidence. His farm included a chemical laboratory with the finest scientific equipment and instruments manufactured and shipped from Europe, along with the many books he purchased from the old world. While indifferent to politics and the clash of empires, he made his oath to the new American Republic and, at the turn of the 18th century, became a long-distance friend to Thomas Jefferson. Sharing of weather readings and microscopic samples such as Spanish moss crawling with microbial life was an intellectual pleasure for both men. Jefferson encouraged Dunbar's scientific contributions, In a letter written from Monticello on June 24, 1799, "It is with great pleasure I have learnt that so distant a post as the Natchez possesses a gentleman so well qualified as yourself to extend inquiries into the regions beyond that. A lover of science cannot lack the requisite zeal to engage his aid in its promotion. We possess little which can be relied on relating to that part of the continent you inhabit, except its mere geography. Its natural history is but little known. Accounts, too, of the Indians of those regions would be very acceptable to the curious. Any information you would be so good as to favor me with on these subjects would be thankfully received. And through the channel of the American Philosophical Society might be communicated to the public. Letters addressed to me at this place near Charlottesville and lodged in any post office of the United States, either in our western country or the Atlantic ports, will be safely forwarded to me. Be pleased to accept assurances of the respect with which I am, sir, your most obedient and most humble servant, Thomas Jefferson." At that point in time, Jefferson was the president of the American Philosophical Society, a position he held from 1797 until retiring in 1814. Though remaining a proud member of and contributor to this first American Society of Scientists till his death in 1826. During those decades, Jefferson also founded the University of Virginia. He served as vice president and then president of the United States, too, of which he was also a founder. The two men, Dunbar and Jefferson, would only meet once in life near the end of Dunbar's life. But Jefferson was pleased to publish a dozen of William Dunbar's fascinating and detailed contributions in the Society's journal. And in 1804, Jefferson assigned a great task to his Scottish-born friend: the grand expedition of the Louisiana Purchase lands of Louisiana and Arkansas. It was on this 104-day journey of discovery that Dunbar studied the Hot Springs waters and was delighted to find microorganisms, what we call extremophiles, thriving in the scalding water. 2 years later, Dunbar would assemble another such scientific voyage for Jefferson, the Great Excursion, this one was called. Although Dunbar's health was in decline and he was unable to make the trip. If these voyages are little remembered today, they were very much admired and appreciated by Jefferson, who sent Lewis and Clark westward in that same year, 1804, as Dunbar's grand expedition. Through it all, astronomy was Dunbar's abiding passion. At the forest, he built a fine observatory and opened it to fellow scientists and students. Possessing the largest telescope in the vast, wild region, Dunbar spent countless hours studying the planets in the heavens. "I have just received from London a 6 feet Gregorian reflecting telescope with 6 magnifying powers, from 100 to 550 times," he proudly wrote to Jefferson in December 1805. It was said by his friends that Dunbar, quote, "was happiest when the sun or moon was in eclipse, or when witnessing the dark sky vision of a passing comet." But of all the strange and wondrous occurrences that William Dunbar recorded in his journals, there was nothing quite like the event of April 5, 1800, over the settlement of Baton Rouge. In Volume 6 of the Transactions of the American Philosophical Society, The following report appears on page 25. Description of a singular phenomenon seen at Baton Rouge by William Dunbar, Esquire, communicated by Thomas Jefferson, President, APS. Natchez, June 30th, 1800. A phenomenon was seen to pass Baton Rouge on the night of the 5th of April, 1800, of which the following is the best description I've been able to obtain. It was first seen in the southwest and moved so rapidly, passing over the heads of the spectators, as to disappear in the northeast in about a quarter of a minute. It appeared to be of the size of a large house, 70 or 80 feet long and of a form nearly resembling figure 5 in plate 4B. It appeared to be about 200 yards above the surface of the earth, wholly luminous, but not emitting sparks, of a color resembling the sun near the horizon in a cold, frosty evening, which may be called a crimson red. When passing right over the heads of the spectators, the light on the surface of the earth was little short of the effect of sunbeams of daylight, though at the same time, looking another direction, the stars were visible, which appears to be confirmation of the opinion formed of its moderate elevation. In passing, a considerable degree of heat was felt, but no electric sensation. Immediately after it disappeared to the northeast, a violent rushing noise was heard, as if the phenomenon was bearing down on the forest before it. And in a few seconds, a tremendous crash was heard, similar to that of the largest piece of ordnance, causing a very sensible earthquake. I have been informed that search has been made in the place where the burning body fell, and that a considerable portion of the surface of the earth was found broken up, and every vegetable body burned or greatly scorched. I have not yet received answers to a number of queries I have sent on, which may perhaps bring to light more particulars. And so ends Mr. Dunbar's report. If you're wondering, the 1908 Tunguska event in the Siberian wilderness was caused by an object estimated to be 30 meters in size, or roughly the same size of the Baton Rouge phenomenon, that passed directly over witnesses before apparently crashing in the nearby woods, which the witnesses investigated in person. The Siberian event flattened the forest for more than 2,000 miles around. The explosion was 1,000 times more powerful than the atomic explosion at Hiroshima. In 2013, a 20-meter asteroid exploded some 30 kilometers over Chelyabinsk, central Russia, without even a direct impact or coming within 20 miles of the surface of the earth. The explosion injured 1,500 people and damaged more than 7,000 buildings. An event such as William Dunbar describes, the direct impact of an 80-foot-long asteroid at Baton Rouge, would have left the entirety of the lower Mississippi Valley destroyed. The forest would have been flattened and burned for hundreds of miles around, and there would be no one alive to describe its flyover. The shock waves and unsurvivable winds of heat and fire would instantly blot out all life. William Dunbar, 124 miles upriver at his forest plantation, would have perished along with everyone else. Whatever the people of Baton Rouge watched and felt pass low over their settlement in the spring of 1800, we can trust Dunbar and President Jefferson's assessment. This was a singular phenomenon. The first scientifically confirmed meteor strike on Earth would happen just 3 years later in Normandy. Following a dramatic meteor shower widely witnessed there, the French Academy of Sciences sent a young astronomer named Jean-Baptiste Biot to investigate. Biot interviewed witnesses and collected several of the strange stones that had fallen from the sky, with the largest fragments being mere inches in length and the heaviest fragment weighing about 10 pounds. Thomas Jefferson received thousands of letters each year, often complaining of being buried in mail, unable to catch up, at the mercy of his many correspondents. This was another of them. A report of an interesting phenomenon mailed to Monticello from Portsmouth, Virginia, and dated July 13, 1813, from Edward Hansford and John L. Clark. Most Honorable Sir, we, the subscribers, most earnestly solicit that Your Honor will give us your opinion on the following extraordinary phenomenon. On the night of the 25th July, we saw in the south a ball of fire full as large as the sun at meridian, which was frequently obscured within the space of 10 minutes by a smoke emitted from its own body, but ultimately retained its brilliancy and form during that period, but with apparent agitation. It then assumed the form of a turtle, which also appeared to be much agitated and as frequently obscured by a similar smoke. It descended obliquely to the west and raised again perpendicular to its original height, which was on or about 75 degrees. It then assumed the shape of a human skeleton, which was frequently obscured by a like smoke, and as frequently descended and ascended. It then assumed the form of a Scotch Highlander, arrayed for battle and extremely agitated, and ultimately passed to the west and disappeared in its own smoke. We are, Honorable Sir, with sentiments of very high respect and esteem, your most obedient, very humble servants, Edward Hansford, keeper of the Washington Tavern in the town of Portsmouth, Virginia, and John L. Clark of Baltimore. Edward Hansford, according to the National Archives, had served as harbor master for the Norfolk and Portsmouth district by 1805 and still served in that role 5 years later. John L. Clark, aged 36 at the time, was a native of Newport, Rhode Island, and had recently been discharged as a master or midshipman in the United States Navy. Clark was a sea captain living in Baltimore at the time of his death in 1816. And so goes the proceedings of our Eldritch Republic. Eldritch being, as you'll recall, a word that was first recorded by Scottish poet William Dunbar in 1508. Another William Dunbar, descendant of that fierce Scottish clan, reported the singular phenomenon over Baton Rouge. And a couple of old salts in Portsmouth witnessed an eldritch phenomenon of their own. A towering figure of fire and smoke in the form of a Scottish Highlander arrayed for battle. In the summer of 1813, they knew what to do. Report this strange vision at once to Thomas Jefferson, the president of the American Philosophical Society. And finally, an eyewitness report submitted to the Historical and Philosophical Society of the State of New York by John M. Brown of Schoharie, New York. About the year 1790, on a clear summer evening, I was sitting on the stoop playing the fiddle. About 9 o'clock in the evening, a shine of light appeared and increased until it overshone even the light of the meridian sun in some clear day, and enlightened my stoop in such a manner that I might have picked up a pin in every corner. Then I heard a great roaring coming from the north. I started up and looked out from the stoop, and behold, I saw a fiery meteor, or as the Germans call it, a mindrake, a dragon coming on and passing by at the distance of about 250 yards west of me, about 60 or 70 feet above the cleared ground. It kept along down through the hollow. On the other side of the hollow, it met with the rising of the hill covered with woods and tall trees. There it took a sudden rise and went just over the tall trees so as not to touch them, and on over a kind of flat or level ground until it met with the foot of the noted hill, called by the Indians Owillisoulis. Then it ascended higher, ascending as the ground rose, and went over the hill where I could not watch it farther. I had had a view of it about a mile and a quarter. It moved about as fast as a common horse in a horse race. The meteor, as I shall now call it, was about 300 yards long in a serpentine shape, excepting the head, which resembled the root of a tree plucked up by force. It had no appearance of a neck, and the body was thick as a bullock, tapering off like a serpent at the end of the tail. The appearance was similar to welding hot iron and sparkling like it. The immense heat warmed through my whole house and left a stench like burning tar and sulfur, which was smelled all the next day. Traditions, superstitions, and fabulous stories are often told of meteors, apparitions, and ghosts, wherein I place but small confidence for want of confirmation. Before the above, mine own eyes and sound mind and body bear witness of the truth I have here related. Thank you for listening, and thanks to our own Red, Blue, Black, Silver for the soundscapes. Visit DesertOracle.com to support this program. Good night.
It's the bottom of the hour, and you are listening to KGVM, Bozeman Community Radio, transmitting at 95.9 FM and streaming at KGVM.org. Continuing our theme of the uncanny and bringing it closer to home, I invited our next guest to share some local legends with us. You've heard her on this show before, and maybe you remember Marlene from the Gallatin History Museum.
Hi, I'm Marlene, and I volunteer at the Gallatin County History Museum. For the last couple years, I have taken people on special tours, and I tell stories in the evening. for Halloween. This year's presentation is called Gallows, Graves, and Other Ghastly Tales. I don't know how many of you believe in ghosts or paranormal activity, but hopefully you'll find these stories interesting either way. Bozeman does have a paranormal society, and it maintains a website. And on the website, they offer tours, field trips, and I will say do testing or investigations for paranormal activity. It's said that some spirits have experienced great sadness, confusion, trauma, or injustice. So many stay in limbo or an unresolved state of suffering. But other times it seems that ghosts have formed a great attachment to a particular building or area, and they just don't want to leave. There's many places in Bozeman that have been tested for paranormal activity, and I guess quite a few places are haunted. I don't have time to tell you all of them tonight, but a couple I will mention are the Rialto. It has a ghost named Pablo Elvira. He was an opera singer who died in the theater. And some people say he's still there, and at times you can hear him singing in the basement. Also, the Ellen Theater has a ghost, and this one likes to be upstairs. And some call him the perverted ghost because he likes to spy on the women in the ladies' restroom upstairs. But I'm going to talk about one of the more interesting ones. And this is a little girl in Bear Canyon. According to the Paranormal Society, there have been many sightings of this little girl. And they say she drowned. I don't know much else about her, except for that she's attracted to women and quite often will call out to them. And then once she gets them following her, she leads them into the forest and gets them lost. They've done some testing and they say she can be quite chatty. And if you see her, she is a small little girl, very pale entity, and normally has some mist around her. I read an entry from somebody on the internet who I think maybe went looking for her or at least knew about this little girl and was maybe combining it with a hike, camping, and fishing. This person left rather late in the day, I thought, for an 8-mile hike. And it was a day that was quite blustery, the wind's blowing, and definitely a storm is moving in. But the hiker went ahead and went. They got to a section that this person called the Aspen Tunnel. And in this part, the aspens grow so close together that they almost grow together at the top. And when you're on the trail, it's quite dark. And, well, this person was in the tunnel. The wind is just absolutely howling. And the leaves are just shaking and shimmering. As this person is walking through the Aspen Tunnel, he or she feels like, through the shimmering leaves, they can see a face of a little girl. And also, we thought maybe there was a small child running on the outside of the tunnel through other trees. The person stopped, just kind of getting themselves very upset and anxious, and thought, you know what? This is just your imagination because you know the story. Really, it's nothing. Just keep on going. And so the hiker did continue and made it to the lake, pitched the tent, had a little bite to eat, and even had some time to go fishing. As it grows to be dusk, the rain begins. And the camper goes into the tent and goes to bed rather early. In the middle of the night, he or she was awoken by some scratching sound on the side of the tent. Again, they are very anxious and have to have this little pep talk again. You know what? It's your imagination. Don't let it get away from you. And it's because you pitched the tent right next to some bushes, and the branches are just scraping the side of the tent as the wind blows. So the camper goes back to sleep, and the next morning gets up, unzips the tent, and notices right away that the rain had turned to snow in the middle of the night. As they step out into the snow, they then see that there are little child-sized footprints in the snow, coming from the lake, going all the way to the site of the tent where the scratching noise was, and then it turned around and went back to the lake. But what was really freaky was the space between the footprints was not the same. In places, the footprints were very close together, like a child walking. And in other places, the footprints were like yards and yards apart, almost as if the child was walking and then sometimes floating. Well, at this, the camper quickly dismantled the tent, threw everything in the backpack, and started running down the trail to the trailhead. Now, I've been asked, since I work in the History Museum, which is located in the old jail, which was built in 1911 and used as a jail until 1982, if we have paranormal activity there. And we have been tested, and there are a couple of spots that were deemed, you know, high activity. And I had to laugh when I heard where those two places were, because they are probably the darkest, creepiest places where visitors could go. Last summer, I was asked by a young man, "Do you have ghosts here?" And I answered, and I still would answer, "No," or I think he asked me if I had ever seen a ghost here. And I said, no, I have not. And then I preface that with, I guess it's because I work during the day and ghosts come out at nighttime and I'm not normally here at night. Well, I'm mistaken about that, because just a few weeks ago, we had some workers coming to replace the floor in the lower level of the museum. And of course, to replace the floor, they had to open doors so they could tuck the new flooring in. And there were doors that I had never seen open before. One of them was in the bookstore area, and it has a chair in front of it. And I just always assumed that it was a closet or a cupboard. When the worker, you know, asked to have it open, he opened the door, and there he was, face to face with a ghost at the top of the stairs. Apparently, there were narrow little stairs that went down to this small, creepy cement room in the basement. What it was used for, I don't know. It's not used for anything now. Well, in the next 2 days that it took to redo all the floor, this same worker saw the same ghost 5 times. Each time in a narrow little stairway, each time they'd look at each other, and then the ghost would turn his back to him and then either float down the stairs, or in the case of the other stairway, he'd float up the stairs to where the sheriff's bedroom is located. So, When the job was done, the foreman of the job informed the ladies in charge of the museum that his worker had, you know, seen this ghost 5 times. The gals brought him into the museum section in the jail, which is the gallows room. The gallows were built inside of the jail because in 1911, that was the main way that they executed people in Montana. There is a big portrait of the one and only person that got hung in those gallows. His name is Seth Danner. And when they pointed to the picture, the man, the worker, who didn't speak English, shook his head, yes, that's who it was. Just a little background on Seth Danner. Seth Danner came to Montana in 1920 with his family. He met up with a couple of friends, and the two families were camping along the Gallatin River. It's November, and they are not on vacation. They are destitute, and the men are going out daily to go fishing or hunting or trapping, or now and then they'd go in to see if they could find some, you know, extra work in town. Well, the two people that they met up with were called Florence and John Sprouse. They disappeared. Nobody missed them for at least a couple years because they weren't from here and they had no children. So no one reported them missing. But in 1923, Seth Danner's wife goes to the sheriff and reports that her husband brutally killed this couple. The sheriff asks, do you know where they're buried? Yeah, she says, I know. And she took them to a place along the river called Central Park. They dug into the ground where she pointed, and sure enough, there were 2 very decomposed bodies. So at this point, they do pick up Seth Danner and bring him in for questioning, and he immediately says, I didn't do it. Actually, my wife is responsible for their deaths, and she's got another man that she has taken up with, and she's just trying to get rid of me. Well, the whole case was kind of he said, she said, and she did testify against him. He never testified against her. And when all was done, he was found guilty. She then took their kids, put them in the state orphanage in Twin Bridges, and took off with another man. Never came back for the kids. Now, there is a book. I did a very streamlined story of it. There's a lot. It's a very convoluted story. And so if you're interested in knowing the whole story, come to the History Museum and you can read about it. Or you can pick up a book called Murder on the Yellowstone Trail. The author of this book used to work for the History Museum. It's based on the newspaper articles. And her bent on it is the wife did it. And she claims that someone on her deathbed, she did confess to killing them and blaming it on her husband. I'm going to change gears here, and I'm going to talk about some ghost towns. I have a passion for ghost towns, and I've made it my project to visit all the main ghost towns in Montana. In fact, Roxana has come with me a couple times, and we've seen a couple of ghost towns. But one of my favorite ones is Bannack State Park, because Bannack has been kept like a real ghost town. It hasn't been commercialized. It's completely opposite of Virginia City, which has been very commercialized and is touristy. Bannock is on Grasshopper Creek, and gold was found there in 1862. This started the first major gold rush in Montana, and because of that, it was the first territorial capital of the Montana Territory. People were coming daily. It started with a tent city of just a few hundred, and in less than a year, there were 3,000 people in Bannock. As the miners were pouring in, of course, a few essentials had to be built, such as saloons, gaming parlors, and houses of prostitution. Sometimes all three could be inside of one facility. The miners were mainly coming from California because the gold rush there was kind of winding down, and so the miners thought they'd try their luck here in Montana. But there's always a criminal element that likes to follow the miners. There are those who work for the gold, and then there's those who just want to take it from them. Well, in this second category was a handsome, educated, well-spoken man named Henry Plummer. He spent time in the California gold fields. In fact, he was sheriff of a little town called Nevada City. While he was sheriff, several people had gotten shot, and most people said it was for self-defense, but he did kind of get on the wrong side of the law and spent a little bit of time in San Quentin. Finally, the governor pardoned him, and then he took off for the Montana Territory. When he arrived in Bannock, he impressed the miners because he was courageous, he was a fast draw, and extremely intelligent. And the miners did know of his criminal background, but in a lawless territory, who wouldn't forgive somebody for shooting somebody in self-defense? So they voted him to be their sheriff. Shortly after this, the real motherlode is found, and it's in Alder Gulch, where Virginia and Nevada City are located. Virginia City grew to 30,000 in its very first year.
Oh, my. Wow.
And, of course, there was an extreme amount of lawlessness. Now, somehow, Henry Plummer not only was sheriff of Bannock, but he somehow got himself installed in Virginia City as the sheriff there also. And people were noticing that there were an extreme numbers of robberies and murders, and especially along the road going back and forth between Bannock and Virginia City. Some of the leaders in these cities got together and decided they needed to do something to clean up this lawlessness. And they met and they formed a secret vigilante committee. They decided that they should write down the names of all the people that they suspected being in the outlaw gang. Some of these people on that vigilante committee actually were founders of Bozeman, such as Nelson Story, Bozeman, John Bozeman, and John Bozeman's friend and buddy, Thomas Cover, who we think probably murdered him. They were all on the committee. So, in the beginning of January, they bring in someone called Red Jaeger, who they thought was part of Plummer's gang. And they questioned him with the threat of death. If you don't tell us who Ounce is in this gang, we're going to kill you. And so, supposedly, he gave up the names of who was in the gang, and he named Henry Plummer as the leader. Now, I will say supposedly because, well, they went ahead and hung him anyway, and so there really was no verification. But it was strange that everybody on his list matched identically the list that the vigilante committee had written down.
Do you mean they hung this guy they were questioning after he gave them the information?
Yes.
So they could have said that he said anything they wanted.
That's exactly. Yeah. So a few days go by, and there's a knock on the door of the Vale's cabin in Bannock. Martha Vale opens the door. It's dark outside. There are three men, all of them armed, and they ask for Henry Plummer. Martha Vale, by the way, was Henry Plummer's sister-in-law.
Mm.
She tells them to go away and come back because Henry is in bed. He's ill. But Henry hears her say this, and he jumps out of bed, and he says, "It's okay, Martha. I think they're here to talk to me about a prisoner I have, Dutch John." And he walks out the door. He doesn't arm himself or anything. He walks out the door, and he sees the cabin is completely surrounded with men, all of them armed. The leader of the group says, "We're not here for Dutch John. We're here for you." Henry replies, "Really? Come on, you guys, you know me." And then the leader, then in a loud voice, says, "How many of you think that Sheriff Henry Plummer is the leader of the outlaw gang named the Innocents?" And everyone raises their hand. "Okay, guilty as charged." And they walk him up the hill to where, just recently, Henry Plummer had a gallows constructed. When they get up there, there are three ropes with nooses on them, and they had also rounded up Henry Plummer's deputies, Ned Ray and Buck Stinson, and they're standing there waiting. Well, they hung the deputies first, and after some pleading, it was Sheriff Henry Plummer's turn, and he realized pleading wasn't going to help, and so he says, "All right, give me a good drop, boys." And they did. So, if you have enjoyed the stories, please tell people to come to the History Museum, Gallows, Graves, and Other Ghastly Tales will be October 30th, 31st, and November 1st. To reserve a place on the tours, which are either 7 or 8 p.m., you need to call 406-522-8122. Again, that's 406-522-8122.
And is there a charge?
There is a charge, $15 per person.
Okay.
Yep.
How about kids? Do they get it?
I would not recommend it for young kids. I'm saying maybe junior high or older.
Okay. Okay. Mm-hmm. All right. Thank you very much, Marlene.
Thank you. Hope you enjoyed it.
Oh, this week my special thanks go to Marlene, and we will bring her back next week with more stories, beginning, I think, with the burial of Mr. Plummer. Thanks to Ken Lane and Red, Blue, Black, Silver for sharing their work on Desert Oracle Radio. Thanks to the volunteers and supporters of KGVM, and thank you for listening. You can leave a voicemail or text for me at 406-404-6246. And you can hear this program broadcast on the air at 95.9 FM, Bozeman Community Radio, or you can stream it online at kgvm.org at 7 Sunday nights and 9 Monday mornings. Our past Desert Oracle Radio replay episodes are also available on demand on the kgvm.org website. I'll be back next week with more desert and mountain lore for you. Till then, watch the skies, keep doing good things, stay well, and sweet dreams. See you next week.